Good afternoon. So my name is Lindsay Gretto. I am here with Public Health Seattle in King County, talking about some of our work with outdoor smoking policy regulation. Not regulations, smoking policies. I have no disclosures to report, and I wanted to note that this project was funded by the CDC's Communities Putting Prevention to Work grant, and so nothing that I am saying is necessarily endorsed by the CDC, just myself. So a little bit of background. With 1.9 million people, King County is the 14th most populous county in the United States. We have 39 cities, including the city of Seattle, and 19 school districts. And we're very lucky to have a strong statewide clean indoor air law, which restricts smoking in workplaces and creates a 25-foot buffer outside of windows, doors, and air intakes. Unfortunately, we don't have the same law as New York City to have areas around health facilities being smoke-free. So I'll get into that later. And this was a citizens' initiative in 2005, and it passed with very overwhelming support. So we're also very lucky to have high public support for tobacco-free places. We also have a lot of partners that are ready and willing to make further changes to protect folks from smoking secondhand smoke. However, it's not all rosy in King County. As in the case of most areas around the country, tobacco use and exposure to secondhand smoke is much more frequent among lower income and non-white race and ethnic populations. And in fact, in our county, residents in low-income households are 7 times more likely to be exposed to secondhand smoke inside their house than are residents of higher income. And in recent years, we have had a massive demographic shift from poverty from the inner city of Seattle to the suburbs in the south end of the city and the south end of the county. And today, more people live in poverty in the suburbs than in the central city. And at the same time, King County has become a destination for refugees from other countries, many of whom smoke. As a result of all of that, King County's health disparities are quite pronounced. In fact, compared to the other large metropolitan counties, we have the highest smoking disparities between income and race. For example, the smoking rate, as you can see on this slide, is 11% for white adults, but it's 21% for African Americans, 31% for Korean men, and 45% for Vietnamese men. We also see very high rates with LGBT, with folks with mental illness. Those rates are a little harder to get. And this slide just shows where we are compared to the other 15 largest counties in the United States. We're the very, very sad red line on the top. And so CPPW, the CDC initiative, gave us an opportunity to address these disparities. So despite our great smoking law, we really want to be able to address ways to protect folks from secondhand smoke and also denormalize smoking. So it basically gave us a way to pay for change and a big fast-forward button for 2 years of big, big work. So we received $10 million for our tobacco work, which was a lot. But it let us create internal staffing, provide funding to partners through large competitive grants. We also did small mini grants, and we provided a lot of outreach and on-the-ground TA for our partners for policy development. And we focused our resources on the south end of the county on where we see our health disparities, even though when we saw low-hanging fruit in other areas, we did not hesitate to snap it up. But we did focus on the south end. And our work was concentrated in the areas you see on the left-hand side of the screen. I sort of grouped them into very wide groups. Since we're talking about other policies here for parks, I'm going to focus on the top one on here, health facilities, since it was a little bit different. And also we focused on voluntary policies with our partners. So our strategy was tobacco-free campuses. Just a bit of a note between smoke-free and tobacco-free. I really wish there was a catch-all term, but there's really not. So we used the very inelegant term with our health facilities of smoke-and tobacco-free. And so the signs at some of our hospitals are kind of interesting. But basically, the health facilities wanted to go beyond just secondhand smoke protection because they are health facilities and they wanted to be able to address some of the things on the bottom here, strengthening tobacco-free norms, preventing youth from starting, and to improve treatment outcomes. And so for this presentation, I'll use tobacco-free, but know that it was also smoke-free. So our first health project was in hospitals. It always sounded a little bit odd to talk about tobacco-free hospitals, especially in a state with a very strong smoking ban. The issue is the smoking on campus of hospitals and patients leaving their bed and leaving their wards to be able to smoke during the day when they are in the hospital. And so the University of Washington applied for a grant from us to work with the University of Washington Medical Center, which is the large academic teaching hospital on the UW campus, to bring them tobacco-free on their campus and also provide treatment models for to be able to let folks be tobacco-free while they're on campus. So cessation protocols for patients, NRT for visitors for free in the gift shop, and making sure that employees have benefits for tobacco cessation. And so they worked with the Washington State Hospital on the Hospital Association, which is our convening group of all hospitals, to do outreach and to try to get hospitals on board to work with us. Since this was voluntary policy, we really had to get people interested in working with us. We couldn't tell them they had to. And so we found that recruitment was a lot easier and it made a lot more sense for them if we tied this work in with the looming, and at that point we thought looming and possibly going away, healthcare reform. And so we were able to show that tobacco-free policies, if folks quit smoking or try to make a quit attempt while they are in the hospital, they might be less likely to smoke when they are out, thus reducing readmissions, which is a measure that is required with the Affordable Care Act. In the end, we worked with 6 total hospitals, 5 that implemented new policies and 1 that made theirs better. And so now 17 of 21 hospitals in our county have smoke-free campuses, which is pretty exciting. And our pilot hospital, UW Medical Center, having them on board early on really helped spur some of the other hospitals. Our hardest, the one that we thought would be our hardest to reach, and this is getting to the next group that we worked with, was our large county-funded public hospital, which is a level 1 trauma center for 4 states. They actually have about a 70% smoking rate for their patients, and their patients were leaving the wards constantly, standing on the street with, you know, red masks because they have tuberculosis or some other diseases. And because they have affiliation with the UW, they went smoke-free at the same time. And they were actually have been our most successful implementer, which is just crazy. and so success factors with our hospitals work. Leadership buy-in was 1. We had to get the leadership on board. The hospitals that we didn't work with were mostly because leadership didn't want to work with us. And so we're hoping on a later date they might. Having the right people at the right time. Also having a project manager, which is hopefully someone that is actually at the hospital. We found that at one time we were working with 4 separate hospitals, all of which had different ways of implementing policy and different ways of writing policy. So with me and the UW overseeing it, it was really really important to have someone at the hospital speaking their language so then we could help them translate our message to their language, but they would be the face of it. If public health was the face of it, a lot of folks would have not been as receptive. We also had an advisory committee at each hospital. The size of that depended on the hospital. At UWMC, we had a room about this big of with a ton of people involved in this for a year. The really important thing was to make sure that we wrapped in all stakeholders at the hospital, to make sure we had smokers in our group, to make sure we had patient advocates, pharmacy, everyone was impacted, facilities, because they were the ones that were going to have to sort of look after the policy. And also having a mix of TA providers let us divide and assist in ways that we could play good cop, bad cop sometimes. And so those are just some of the pretty signs. So then behavioral health, that led into behavioral health policies. If you don't know what behavioral health is, it's mental health and substance abuse treatment. They're wrapped in together. In our state, they're starting to wrap them into one one bucket. And this work really was supported a lot by the hospital's work. The idea was to create a continuum of care. So if someone was in the hospital and then they went to inpatient treatment and then outpatient treatment, they would receive the same message the whole time. And consumers of behavioral health treatment have some of the highest smoking rates. For some diagnoses, it's up to 90% smoking rate. So it's just a monster of a population that we need to work with and that oftentimes we don't work with. There's a pretty pervasive belief that we're starting to shoot some holes in that on that consumers of behavioral health treatment don't want to quit smoking. That's not true at all. They do want to quit smoking at the same rates or even higher. And their income that they spend on tobacco is just, it's like all of their take-home income. And so what we did is we worked with another county agency. So we're public health, and we worked with the behavioral health agency. And they had been long-term partners with us trying to, you know, cajole some of their treatment centers to be able to do tobacco work. They oversee 108 sites. But that wasn't totally working. And so what they wanted to do was require them to have tobacco-free campuses and also screen and treat tobacco. And so then what we did was actually put it in their funding contracts. And so now any agency that is contracted with the county to do treatment, so any public agency that they all serve low income, has to be tobacco-free. It was a huge project and one that we thought would have a lot of resistance. One of our main strategies for dealing with that was we did a survey really early on of all staff in all of the sites. We had almost 600 respondents to our survey. And then we were able to use that data to show directors of the organizations who were generally the most resistant that their staff did in fact want to work on this and would help us with it. So that was very helpful. We did a lot of TA. We've trained over 500 counselors and other treatment staff. We did monthly sessions. We're still doing monthly sessions for new staff. They come to us and we train them on tobacco. We go to their sites. We've gone to 25 different agencies and done on-site TA. We've brought in nationally recognized speakers for special events. And we're holding monthly conference calls with our champions, with our site champions. We also provided carbon monoxide monitors, which are really fun, but it's a really great biofeedback tool so that counselors can show their patients how smoking is affecting them. It really ties it into the model of recovery. Before treatment centers would talk about AOD instead of ATOD, they would say, we do alcohol and other drug treatment, and so we wanted to add the tobacco back into that and show that it is an addiction and recovery from substances does include tobacco. So they actually called the initiative In Recovery and Tobacco Free. So putting a positive spin on things really, really helped. So I think I pretty much just talked about this slide. just make sure I did not miss anything. Oh, the social justice framework, that was huge. It's just such a big disparity that we don't talk about that we really tried to make this make that our message that these folks are not given the opportunity that other people are. And so some of the treatment agencies, this is actually a sign from our county detox facility, which everyone said, oh, there's no way they're going to do this. They were our first. And they created this beautiful sign where they're just basically saying that they're proud to support recovery and wellness, and this is why they are tobacco free. So it's very exciting. So lessons learned. This is for both of our healthcare projects. When we say 6 to 12 months of planning, it really depends on who you're working with. One of our hospitals did it in 2 months just because they were ready and had been talking about it. On the picture on this slide is actually from our county hospital. This is one of the, they put up flyers next to the no smoking signs that were like near things to show that this is really real in a couple of weeks, and they counted down to show people that, hey, you're actually not going to be able to smoke here. They actually had smoking areas too, and they put big signs in the smoking areas 6 weeks leading up to the initiative. I already talked about the advisory committee, that I do not think that we would have succeeded without the advisory committees. Developing policy enforcement and monitoring procedures, that was very important early on. And it's actually a current challenge that we have when we talk about litter. The biggest challenge we have right now is litter around these hospitals. You walk up to the hospital and next to the campus, where it's public land, is a line of cigarette butts. And one hospital responded to that by creating a receptacle, which they thought would help get litter away. It created a smoking area. So with voluntary policies, we tried to say, please don't do it, please don't do it, please don't do it, but they did it anyway. So I would love to talk to you about some strategies about that. Providing clear and consistent communication. We just had to beat them over the head. 2 days leading up to one of our policies, the residents at the hospital said they hadn't heard about it, so they weren't going to do it. And we had, you know, signs all over the hospital. They had been emailed, it had been in their meetings, and so they almost shut it down, but they did not, which was good. And making sure folks have access to support to quit tobacco. In our state, we had halfway through this project, our state tobacco program and our quit line got defunded. And so we were, you know, making policies and driving people to the quit line when they got turned away. Because if you weren't a King County resident, where we had CPPW money and could pay the quit line, you couldn't have access to it. And so we worked with the hospitals to get NRT in their systems. Like I talked about, they had free patches and gum in the gift shops for visitors, because we knew that if they didn't live in King County, which if you're going to the hospital, you might not live in the county of that hospital, they wouldn't have access. And we were not okay with that at all. And also knowing that people do adjust to the changes very quickly. It's like smoke-free restaurants and bars. It seems like a really bad, it seems very freak out. People freak out for the few months ahead of time. And after it happens, it's like, oh, that wasn't so hard. So we continued to tell them that. So I think that is the biggest lesson learned. It's no different than other smoke-free policies. So I just wanted to thank our partners, Abigail Halperin, some of you might know, from the UW, was our hospitals grantee. Sherry McCabe and Jim Vollendroff was our behavioral health grantees. Deanne Crump was our evaluator. And our amazing health educators at our tobacco prevention program really made my job much, much easier. Anyway, thank you.